welcome to episode 419 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Nathan Fox. With me is Ben Olson. We're the founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. You can be LSAT famous, share news, and ask questions on our website, thinkinglsat.com. This Thursday, September 14th, opportunity to take a free LSAT class with me. I'm teaching at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. It's going to be a regular version of my two-hour, all-levels, all-topics Thursday night class. It's appropriate for all students. I don't care if it's your first day of LSAT or your last day of LSAT. We do real LSAT questions. You guys tell me what you struggle with, and I explain it 10 different ways until I can see that you get the click. That's the idea, is that I just want to help you understand how easy the LSAT actually is. Go to lsat.link/free if you'd like to sign up for that class. Again, it's Thursday, September 14th at 5 p.m. I saw this thing on, I was car shopping on a forum, and I live in a very dirty place. And I was just kind of like, hey, you know, what colors of cars show dirt the least? And I saw this. You want to read it, Ben?
Yeah, it says, black shows dirt the most, so white likely shows it the least.
And when you read that at the top of the agenda, you started laughing. Why were you laughing?
Well, it's certainly going from one extreme to the other, right? And in fact, it reminded me of an LSAT question that touched on the same idea. I feel like it was the one with the moths.
Yep, right? There was one about moths where it was like the black ones blend in the best, so therefore the white ones must blend in the worst. Something like that.
Yeah.
That wasn't exactly right.
No, it was black blends in more than white. I don't know. I can't remember now.
Yeah. But yeah. Anyway, it is a pretty commonly tested flaw, fairly commonly tested flaw, this just ignoring of the middle ground. Like, you know, if it's a bad idea to make zero investment, therefore it must be a great idea to make a huge investment, that type of thing. And it's like, well, wait a second. There are, you know, there's some middle ground. There's some gray area. And anyway, it's a little lesson in what kind of an asshole you turn into when you steep yourself in LSAT. Because yeah, you just can't read anybody's comments anywhere without finding all kinds of these just dumb logic things in real life.
Well, apparently it happens in law school, too. My contracts professor said the very first week of class, hey, everyone, don't bring home what we talk about here to class or to your home. Don't bring home what we talk about in class to your home life experience. It won't go well for you.
Yeah.
Because I guess enough students had just gone home and started arguing, right? Like in the same way, like, oh, don't you understand? That's illogical. And it's just like, no one wants to hear that. That's not great for your relationships.
Yeah. Telling your kids that there was no consideration on that offer you had made them. Yeah. Sorry, kid, no ice cream for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We have a couple of quick PSAs here. You want to dive into these?
Sure. So number one, thanks to listener Dastin for a follow-up on copy-paste functionality on LSAT writing. You can copy, cut, and paste on your submission response, but not on the original. I'm sorry, not on the digital scratch paper.
So, and we have a screenshot here of what it looks like in LawHub anyway. So I'm looking at just what the form looks like. Why is there even scratch paper?
I don't know. Why not just write in your actual,
Yeah, I do see that there's a button here to collapse the scratch paper. I would just collapse the scratch paper and just use your actual writing area, the panel over on the right. That's a big panel where you're going to write your whole response. And if you can use the copy paste functionality in that panel, well, then just don't even use the scratch paper. So this is a little bit of a correction from a previous episode where you said you can't use copy paste on the LSAT writing, which would have been crazy, but you can use it as you're writing your response. You just can't do it from the scratch paper to the response. Easy solution. Just don't use the scratch paper.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that just because it's so silly. And it's funny, too, that LSAC, or I guess the test itself, literally says right below the scratch paper header, nothing typed here will be included in your response. Cut, copy, paste are disabled here.
Right.
Like what? It's so, it's they're very aware of what they're doing. So why are they doing it? I would 100% collapse the scratch paper tool and just use the essay portion. And then when you're done, just delete your notes. You don't need them.
Yeah. Or write. Yeah. As you're writing, right? You just kind of incorporate your notes into the thing.
Into the actual essay. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty simple. Just don't use the scratch paper functionality on the LSAT writing. Okay. How about this next one?
Number two, new dates added to the October and November LSAT, both remote and in person. In addition to the already published test dates for October, which were apparently the 13th and 14th, we have added test sessions on Sunday, October 15th and Monday, October 16th. Same for November. It was we already have November 10 and 11, but they are adding Wednesday, November 8th and Thursday, November 9th. So interesting there. They went after the 2 days after the October dates, and then they went 2 days before the November dates. So they're really giving people a lot of options. If you can't do, geez, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Monday, well, you have Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or Saturday in November.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of options there. They're doing this in response to the shit show that was the August administration of the test. Many people did the retake successfully, people who were not able to take their test successfully in August. And there were many of them. They like some portion of them decided not to take the free retake and instead kick it down the road to October or November. So there's going to be a bunch of additional test takers they're anticipating for those two administrations. That's why they added these dates. Anyway, lots more flexibility for test takers at these next two administrations. I don't see how that's anything but a good thing. Do you?
More dates. Yeah.
Yeah. More dates seems good.
Yep.
August LSAT scores were released and we had a whole bunch of shout outs. Maybe Ben, we can alternate on these. Demon student Alex started with a 141 diagnostic, scored a 162 in April, kept going and scored 175 in August, despite a 3 hour stoppage in the middle of the test. Then we have a quote here from Alex. Instead of panicking, I meditated, kept my composure, and remembered after 3 hours, it is just a dumb test. I don't think it's a dumb test, Alex. I think it's a really smart test. It makes a lot of sense. It makes perfect sense. And it's a really good test of the things that you're going to be doing in law school and beyond. But you had a great attitude there to just say, whatever, make me wait. That's fine. When I come back, I know that I'm just going to be answering answerable questions. So what difference does it make if I do it right now or if I do it in a little while? You want to take the next one?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, I think he meant dumb, right? Just like, it's just another dumb thing in the world.
Yeah, just another.
It's a smart test. I agree with you.
Inconsequential thing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, another dumb thing. Yeah, yeah. Well, wow. So 141 to 175, 34 points. Shit.
Yep.
That's amazing. Next one. Another demon student, also named Alex, had a similar experience. Quote, the best advice I can give to future test takers is to treat the test how you treat your practice problems. Because of your advice, I wasn't stressed during the problematic fiasco and killed the test after being rescheduled. Alex scored 174 and is retaking in September.
Love Holy that. Shit. I mean, yeah. There's twice as many people now score 175 and higher. And Alex recognizes that they're not currently in that top tier of scores. Thinks they can do better. Absolutely retake it. Why not? There's really no downside. So that's great. Ikey underperformed on the June LSAT because he got caught up watching the clock. He forced himself to ignore the clock on the August test and scored a 178. Ikey says, special thanks to Matt, Nathan, Rebecca, Francesca, and the whole Demon team. You guys made the experience a hell of a lot more enjoyable. Ikey is also a big proponent of the GLAD order of operations when applying to law school, which again is GPA first, then LSAT. Once you've got the LSAT totally done, then you think about applying. Then once you get your decisions back, that's when you make your big decision. That's what the D stands for. That's when you decide which offer you're going to take or even whether you're going to go at all. But you do them in that order so that you make sure that you give yourself the best possible outcomes in your applications.
Yeah. I mean, geez, getting a 178, right? That just sets you up.
Ike emailed me and asked if I thought he should retake because his range is like 177 to 180.
I'm assuming you said, don't worry about it.
I said, don't worry about it. You mean you're there, you're above the 75th percentile at every single school. I really don't think there's a big difference between 177s and 178s and 179s and 180s. Yeah. I haven't seen any evidence to suggest that that's true. In fact, I have seen evidence the other way where some law schools seem to kind of get off on being able to say that they have denied 180s. I think they like probably every 5-10 years, you know, they make sure that they deny a 180 just so that they can say they did it.
Yeah. Oh, you're so selective. You can deny a 180. Great. Yeah. Congrats. Yeah. Rebecca took her first official LSAT in 2020. She scored a 168. She just scored a 177 in August. She says, quote, "What a game changer the demon has been. I was a live student and loved attending classes. Special shout out to cross training with Eric." Eric is also the one who included this comment on the show.
Hey, he didn't put it first. he put it down there quite a ways.
Yeah, in the middle. Good, Eric.
Yeah. Thank you, Rebecca. Courtney scored 180 on the August test and says, "I am officially saying goodbye to the LSAT Demon platform, but you and the whole LSAT Demon team will be missed. Thank you both so much for the time and energy you put into this. The LSAT is better for it." Well, you're the one, Courtney, who's really putting in time and energy.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, when I'm teaching LSAT, it doesn't feel like work at all. And it doesn't take, I get energy from it when I'm doing it. It's just a fun test that you can make sense of. And it's just so fun to see the light bulb going on. And I know that we are consistently delivering results like this. And that feels really amazing. I hope everybody will come give us a try if you haven't done it already. My free class, again, on September 14th would be a great opportunity to give it a shot. But yeah, we're in the business of delivering 25-point improvements to people. The people who really listen to us and really do what we ask end up transforming. I don't think it's a stretch to say that they transform their entire legal careers by transforming their LSAT.
Yeah, it's a totally different application process, which means a totally different set of schools, which means a totally different experience in law school. And then what outcomes are going to come from that? It's like almost not quantifiable.
It's just instant big leagues.
Yeah.
You know, well, maybe not instant. Once you achieve that score though, right? Once you get that LSAT back, the one that really reflects your true potential.
Yeah.
Welcome to the big leagues. You know, no longer trying to scratch your way into some mediocre regional school. Now it's just multiple offers from schools all over the place. And it's a pleasure to be able to do it. It's really a joy to teach and to work with such smart, hardworking people, right?
Yeah.
It's an amazing community. So, yeah. Anyway, see you in the demon, hopefully.
Hey, this isn't on the agenda, but I want to talk about for half a second. So I was looking at our videos on YouTube the other day. I think after Eric posted them, he sometimes sends them out, says, "Hey, they're live."
Yeah.
And so, of course, when I'm on YouTube, it's suggesting other LSAT related videos because it's like, you're clearly interested in the LSAT. I said, yeah, OK. And this one video came up from this lady who had lots and lots of followers and lots of people watching her videos. But I was struck because she had one video where she was logging in and looking at her LSAT score, right? She's like recording herself as she's seeing her LSAT score.
Yeah.
And she has these notes on the side of the video. She's like, okay, if it's above a 158, I'm not going to retake it. I'm done. And then she ended up getting something lower. I think it was like a 153 or a 152 or something like that. And she was crushed. And you're like watching her, you know, go through this process. And then she starts talking to herself about how, like, okay, maybe I can still apply to some of these schools with this score.
Ugh.
And I was just like, I wish, you know, it's interesting to me that so many people watch this and I don't know what they think of those scores or how, what their thought process is, it is, but here, you know, you can see her talking herself into this lower score. I mean, even from our perspective, a 158 is fine, whatever, you got a 158, but you can and probably should do so much more because you just have to work a little bit harder and that can push you into such a different echelon of schools. So I just wonder how many people out there are still settling for scores that are so much lower than what they could get. Yeah.
I confidently say that it's more than half of all applicants end up settling for less than they could. I mean, it's probably like 90% of all applicants don't really give the LSAT their best shot. That's why our students get scholarships. Yeah. I mean, that's that lady. That's great. I'm glad there are, you know, I'm glad there are lots of her because that's what makes our students be able to, you know, work their ass off, study hard, improve their LSAT by 15, 20, 25, 30 points. What is the one up at the top of the
34
yeah. points for Alex? I mean, you know, people just totally transform their application that way. And then that lady pays their law school tuition. That's how it works. They get a scholarship. She doesn't. She pays twice what she should pay. Our students pay little, you know, because they got such a great LSAT. People, I don't know. There's so much bad advice out there, right? People think that it's impossible to improve. People think, you know, you see shit all the time that's like, well, you know, the average people really, when they retake the LSAT, they only improve by a point or two on average. So it's not worth it.
Yeah.
One, it would be worth it to improve a point or two. Yeah. Two, our students improve by a hell of a lot more than that. You know, not like guaranteed on the very next test. But if you do the things we're asking you consistently, I know that your scores are going to improve. It's just not possible not for that to happen. And people do end up improving by double digits.
Yeah.
At least. Okay, not everybody kills it on their first attempt or their second attempt or their third attempt for that matter. And by the way, not everybody kills it on their fourth attempt. I had in class this last week TAing for me. I had awesome Elizabeth, who is a rising 2L at Harvard Law School. Mm. She took the LSAT 5 times. She got like 160, low 160 something, low 160 something. She wasn't prepared for the test. Then she started studying with us. She got a 164, disappointed, retake. 164, disappointed, retake.
That was her fourth attempt, was a 164? Fourth attempt. Yeah.
She was with the demon at that point. She knew her practice tests were higher. She knew she could do better. So she took it again. She got a 175. She's at Harvard Law School. Totally killing it.
She would not be at Harvard.
She would not be at Harvard Law School if she had not retaken it again. And she would not be at Harvard Law School if she hadn't waited another cycle. I was just yesterday playing Gloomhaven with my buddy John Yin. John Yin is also a Harvard 2L. He's taken some time off. Things are working out fabulously for him, even though he's barely starting his like second year of classes. He's already got 2 summers of jobs lined up. He's already got his post-graduation job lined up in tax law. Like the dude is just killing it completely.
Wow.
He applied in 2 different cycles. I think he said he only got into 3 of the 30 applications that he sent in. But his ultimate 178 that he got on the LSAT after multiple retakes, his 178 gets him into Harvard Law School. And he's just killing it. And he just changed his life completely.
Yeah.
So don't be shy about retaking it. It's always better to retake if you think you can do better. If your practice tests indicate you can do better, then you should always retake.
Yeah.
Unless you're Ike and you've already got a 178 and you're, you know, like, don't do that. But potentially a 174, like Alex at the top, 174, but know you can do better because your practice test record indicates that you can for sure do better. Well, yeah, 177 is going to be in the 75th percentile for Yale. 174 isn't. So maybe it's worth it for you to retake.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about the people who it didn't go so well for them. We got several emails from students who didn't score as highly as they'd hoped. Here's some common questions. Go ahead, Ben.
Number 1, I underperformed relative to my PT scores, practice test scores. What did I do wrong?
My response is, what did you do different? Differently?
Differently is technically correct.
What did you do differently?
Apple made us want to all say different. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Think different. What did you do differently?
Yep.
Because I think if you do some like soul searching, you'll realize that you did actually do something differently.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Did you go a little bit faster, hoping that this would be the time that you finished that section of reading comp and you normally don't? Or did you go a little bit slower, triple checking wrong answer choices instead of treating it like a practice test where we just confidently dismiss nonsense answers? Were you like in there with a garbage answer, like really trying to understand what it says?
Yeah.
What else can you do differently on your test day that can lead to underperformance?
Well, those are the two big ones, I think, for sure. But also maybe leaving the timer on when you've normally turned it off.
I've heard of people doing that. Yeah. You're used to turning the timer off on your practice tests, but then on the real thing, you're like, no, but this is, I can't risk running out of time.
Yeah. Yeah. This is real.
Yeah. Anything that you do differently? I've heard of people skipping around where
I'm going to skip. Yeah.
They never did that on any of their practice tests. And then on their official test, they're like, well, but there was this one really weird logical reasoning question, so I decided to skip it and come back to it.
Yeah.
What? You never did that on any of your practice tests?
Or you flag questions and you've never flagged them before.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, right now we're talking about things that happen inside of the test, but there's the things that happen before the test too, right? So many times I've heard of people who never run in the morning, but on test day, oh, they're going to have the perfect day. So they get up, they run, they have their big breakfast, and then they're like zonked for the test because they've never done that in their normal life.
Yeah. People who decide to start drinking coffee or 5-hour energy.
Yeah.
Even though they normally don't do that.
Yeah.
Or take their roommate's Ritalin prescription, even though they normally don't do that.
Okay. Yeah.
People who stop drinking coffee on the day of the test for no reason.
Yeah.
I think that using one of the Prometric testing centers is by definition doing something different. You're not doing that on any of your practice tests.
Yeah.
You know, and go like, I don't really care. Like, I don't care about the difference between LSAT Demon tests and LawHub tests. I don't think that the format of the tests matters. I don't think the difference in the software matters enough that you should worry about it. But I do think you should worry about, like, if you have a safe place, a quiet, comfortable place with solid internet where you've been taking all your practice test scores, I think you're insane for going to one of these Prometric test centers to take your official test. Why would you do that to yourself?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you just take it online? And sometimes people do that. Dig deep, though. Think about what it is that you did differently. Because if you underperformed like below your range, you know, your last 10 practice tests is 160 to 170 and you scored 152 on your official.
Yeah.
You had to do something differently. You weren't treating it like it was just another practice test. And that's, in general, I guess that's the one piece of advice, right? Treat the official test like it's just another practice test and you'll be fine. But the second you start going out of that, the second you start doing something different, then you're going to get yourself in trouble. How about this next type of email?
Yeah. So question two, many students ask something like this. You say it's important to apply early. If I retake, I'll have to wait until after the October LSAT to apply. Should I apply now with my good but not great score from August or retake and apply later this cycle with a better score? There's a baked in assumption there.
The third option, of course, is that you just apply in a later cycle, potentially, because if you put yourself in this pressure, I mean, it's dumb to apply now with your good but not great score. I don't think that that's a good strategy. You're wasting money and time on applications.
Time and effort. Yeah. You always have to make the number one thing the number one thing.
Right.
Otherwise, it's not the number one thing. And you're treating applications or the timeline or something as more important than the LSAT score.
Right. Priority means there's just one thing, right?
Yeah.
So you have to make LSAT your priority. Well, assuming you're already done with undergrad, GPA is already in the books. Now it's time to turn to the L in GLAD and work on your LSAT. And you should work on your LSAT until you're done with your LSAT. Then think about applications. So many people get themselves in a bad position, especially this time of year, because they start hoping so much that their September score or their August score rather is going to be good enough to apply right now. And then it's not. And it's like, well, okay, you added stress to your August LSAT by hoping that it was going to be the one. Now, if you apply and retake, or if you just wait and hope like, well, I'm going to take it in October, then apply, you're doing the same fucking thing that you did in August.
Yeah.
Where it's like, well, okay, now this one is the one that I'm really hoping for.
You're forcing yourself to limit your number of retakes, right? It's just, it's really bad, bad, bad. Don't trade the next 12 months of your life for the next 40 years of your career.
And it comes from, it comes from the law schools themselves and well-meaning pipeline organizations. We're going to see later when we get into some notes from this LSAC event that just happened. There are so many forces out there that are trying to get you to apply this cycle. They're just, it's insidious, but they never, ever encourage you to think about waiting another cycle. They, if a school is talking to you today, they want your application this cycle.
They want it now.
Cause they're salespeople. It's like, if you go to the car dealership, like they don't want you to buy a car next year. They want you to buy a car today.
Well, and you have to understand too, that when, if they were to say, no, no, wait, they're dramatically increasing the likelihood that they will never see you again. So it's not a choice for them between now and next year. It's not like they're like, oh, well, do we want you now or do we want you next year? For them, it's, do we want you now or never? Because you're going to be gone if you don't buy now. And that's the same with car salesmen, right? That's why they want you to buy today. Because when you walk away, your chances of coming back are close to zero.
Right. Because you leave and you end up getting a better LSAT and you end up not going to that stupid school in the first place. Or you leave and you realize, hey, you know what? There's these other schools that I didn't even think were in my range, but I'm going to apply to those schools now. You apply broadly instead of applying to just one school. Every school is like, oh, yeah, no, our applications are still open. And yeah, you should apply right now. It's, oh, what are you talking about? No, it won't be too late in the cycle.
Yeah, we got early decision in March. March 25th.
Bullshit like that. If people would just decouple it, if they would just be like, okay, I'm going to law school at some point in the future. First step is I got to get a killer LSAT. If I get a killer LSAT, this is going to change my whole legal career.
Yeah.
Forget about applications. I don't give a shit. I don't care. Don't worry about your personal statement. Stop it. Stop wasting time on your personal statement. Just work on your LSAT until you get an official LSAT on record that kills it. Then everything else is going to be so simple. It's so easy. Yeah, once you have your killer LSAT.
If you're struggling to believe this, just imagine for a second what would happen if you had a 172 on record or a 174 or a 176. What would happen?
Yeah, visualize it. Yeah.
What would it be like to approach schools knowing that you have that score in your back pocket? That's what you can get. That's the power you get.
Yeah.
And by the way, this flaw in the LSAT. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I gave two examples earlier of students who are actually at Harvard Law School now who would not have been there if they wouldn't have waited another cycle. And it's, you know, and they did, though. And Elizabeth said it in class. She's like, oh, but I was definitely doing that thing where I was hoping that this one would be the one, like on attempt number one and two and three and four. Mm-hmm. She's given herself all this pressure because she's like, well, I want to apply as soon as possible. I want to apply as soon as possible. Maybe I'm messing up some of the details on her story, but I know she was doing that to herself at some point along the line. Eventually, she like actually drank the LSAT demon Kool-Aid and was like, oh, OK, so I need to just plan on using all of my attempts if necessary. Ends up with her 175, and she wouldn't even have applied to Harvard if she wouldn't have taken the LSAT her fifth time.
Yeah, it would be silly, right? Oh, I got a 164. Good luck with that.
John Yin had gotten in, I believe, to Wash U in St. Louis, and they had only given him like a small scholarship. Mm. And that was his best offer from the previous cycle. He almost went and paid tuition
at Wash U.
At Wash U. Wow. And instead, he ends up at Harvard with all of amazing things that Harvard has to offer.
They don't offer scholarships, right? So I guess he ends up paying.
He ends up paying.
Depending on his financial needs, yeah.
But he also ends up with, like, he has had some struggles. He's had, I don't think he would mind if I said a little bit of this. He's had some, like, family issues. He's had some health issues in his family, health issues personally. He's like had a struggle of his first like probably 18 months at, or maybe now it's 2 years. I don't even know. It's like it's been a while, right? Mm. But he's been at Harvard and he's like had to drop out of a couple semesters, take medical leave, that type of thing, right? Also, he has highly lucrative jobs lined up already.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, because when you go into a school like that, then it's just like, oh yeah, don't worry about it. You're Harvard Law School. Like, well, the employers take care of you, right? It's not Harvard doing anything. It's just, yeah, okay, it's Harvard. So even if you're the very last person in your class, you're still going to get hired to like any job. You know, like, you just waltz right into a $200,000 plus salary right out of law school. If you want to do, you know, he's going to do like big, it's tax law.
Yeah.
In a big firm, which is what his background is tax law and accounting. But he would not have waltzed into a lucrative job like that from some other school. It's at Harvard that, and it's just because he was patient, then all the good things come to him.
Yeah. And to be clear, not all this, not everyone has to gain these benefits by going to Harvard. You can be going from a 155 to a 167.
Yeah.
And still just, yeah, you're not maybe going to end up at Harvard, but you're going to end up at a much better school than you would have, and ideally for free, and maybe even with a stipend. It's just astronomically different.
It is life-changing at every level. I mean, if you can even improve by 10 points, it changes your life at every level. If you're a 150, you're not getting into very many reputable law schools. You're not getting into any, you know, top 25 law schools. And if you improve that to a 160,
and you're paying,
and you're paying full price everywhere you go. If you bump that to a 160, now you're getting full ride scholarships at regional schools, and you're probably going to be like kind of knocking on the door of some of the top 25, or I don't know what the numbers are exactly, but just the point is, yeah. If you could add 10 to your LSAT, you would be a completely different applicant. So don't be forcing in an application right now, hoping that a later LSAT bails you out. Don't be planning on like, I hope the October test. Is it too late to apply? Well, just stop worrying about it. Just wait until you have your actual score. Then apply. Take a breath. Things will work out so much better for you if you do. And I don't know, Ben. I think we're like the only people who say this.
That's wild.
All us and all of our armies of like graduates who have done what we asked and who have had like fabulous outcomes.
Yeah.
Okay. We have a slightly related to the above question about retaking.
This is from Anonymous. The subject is diminishing returns on retakes. Okay. Well, we just talked about retaking. Hi, Ben and Mr. Hastings. At what point does retaking the LSAT become worthless? Should I retake until I'm at above all medians? Maybe I got to be above Yale's 75th, so I should go for a 179? Wait, you don't need a 179 to be above the 75th, right? I feel like the 75th is 176. Anyways.
It was. I mean, I would anticipate that that's climbing. I think I might have actually looked at their most recent 509 and it was 177. But anyway, yeah.
Okay. To hell with it. Anything less than a 180 shows you have flaws. So retake anything below a 180. Maybe Dean Z will yield protect me if I retake anything above 172. So I should stop there. In all seriousness, at what point does a 170X have the same strength as a 180? I think a 178, what we already talked about earlier, that's pretty safe.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, it's just kind of a silly question because it depends. It depends where you're applying. If you're applying to Hastings, you know, there's no difference between a 172 and a 180 because you're already a mile above their 75th percentile.
Yeah.
If you're applying to Yale, then there's a big difference between a 172 and a 180, because 172 might not even be, well, it's not even their median, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so you're lowering the LSAT profile of the school if you apply to Yale with a 172.
Oh, okay. Hey, look, so on their 2022 509 report, Yale's 75th percentile is 178.
Yeah, because the scores at the real elite level have more than doubled. Again, we've said this on like every episode of the recent show, but I think it does bear repeating that since COVID, also since the LSAT demon, scores of 175 or higher have more than doubled.
Yeah.
That's just a fact. It's, you know, make of that what you will. But if you're serious about a school like Yale, who the fuck do you think Yale is going to admit? Well, all those people are, you know, probably serious contenders for Yale. So if you want to go to the elite of the elite of the elite, you're going to need a higher score. But if you're talking about UCLA, you know, I think a 176 and a 177 are probably exactly the same at UCLA, because you're already above, well above their median. You're probably above their 75th there. Mm-hmm. And it probably doesn't make a difference. But we can't give, you know, who knows? Next year, maybe Yale's 75th is 179. Don't really know.
Yeah.
But I still don't think I should retake that 178. I just don't see any point. Okay. We have a document here. Are you going to click into this Google Doc?
Yep.
Take a look at this. We had someone send us very helpful notes from an event called the LSAT and Test Prep, Plan Your Journey. And this was hosted by Law School Admission Council and attended by Law School Admission Council folk. And then there was also someone there called Adria Kimbrough, who is affiliated with the Legal Defense Fund's Marshall Motley Scholars Program. Do you remember when this first came across our desk? We got like probably LSAC told us, hey, invite your students to this.
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we look at the event, and the first thing that like was a red flag for us is that it was an event that was happening on August 31st of 2023, and it was explicitly for people who plan to start law school in fall of 2024.
So, yeah, a year later, right? You're going to be starting law school. You're going to be going in, taking your 1L classes, which means you applied right after this.
Right, because applications are now open for fall of 2024. And the people who have been listening along, the people who have been following our advice, the people who have been doing what Elizabeth did, the people who have been doing what John Yin did, they're done with their LSAT at this point. They're done with their LSAT. Potentially 6 months ago, they were done with their LSAT, waiting to apply at the beginning of the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this LSAC event is just, they're giving everybody this impression that, you're just now starting to think about the LSAT. You're just now starting to think about test prep. Perfect. You can start law school in fall of 2024. What?
Yeah.
Because those, some of our, you know, like Taylor, who teaches for us.
Yeah.
She's applying this cycle. She's busy right now. She can't take on as many tutoring students as she'd like, because she's applying with her 170, whatever it is.
Yeah.
For she's applying for 2024.
Yeah.
So do you want to compete with Taylor?
She's done with her LSAT. She's done extraordinarily well. And now she's focused 100% on applying in September.
Right. And if you think you're going to try to apply for fall 2024 to compete with Taylor, it's like, well, wait a second. Her LSAT is already killer and it's already done. You've got to start thinking, like researching your options for LSAT prep.
Yeah.
Also, you're going to do your personal statement, your applications, all that paperwork. You're going to do that stuff while you're prepping for the LSAT. Taylor's just doing that, because her LSAT's already done. Anyway, at this event, 75% of the participants responded to a poll saying that they do plan to start law school in fall 2024 or spring 2025, which most law schools start in the fall. So spring 2025 is like real slim portion of those people. But this is people, 75% of the people at this event are like, yeah, I'm starting in fall 2024. Well, these are all those people that we were talking about earlier, Ben, who like they don't work hard enough at the LSAT. They don't retake the LSAT. They don't plan on retaking it multiple times. They said, and this was the woman from the Legal Defense Fund said, oh, yeah, you're in a good spot if you take it in November. And then they even posted this chart. When do I want to start law school?
Mm-hmm. So then the first column is the time you want to start law school, right?
No. Yes, yes, yes. So if you want to start in fall of 2024, it says, then it is excellent if you take the LSAT in summer of 2023, June through August. But it's also good if you take the LSAT in fall of 2023, which is September through November.
Wow. So this is like reminiscent of the red light, yellow light, green light.
Similar. Yeah. And apparently right at the top, they just had no discussion of the implications of applying in September versus the implications of applying in December or January, which the implications are pretty clear. There are better scholarship offers and better offers of admission for people who apply in September than for people who apply in December or January. And if you take the LSAT in November, you are definitely applying in December or January. Not only that, but, and this is maybe the worst part of it to me, they don't acknowledge retakes. It's like, when should I take the LSAT? Well, when do you want to start law school? Oh, you want to start law school in fall of 2024? Okay, great. So you're still good. You can take the LSAT in September to November of this year.
Take it. You're done. Congrats. Yeah,
take it. Get a shitty score. You're done. Right. Do some half-ass, like get an LSAT book and like look at a test. Okay. Yeah, I got it. I'm ready. I know what's going on here. You know, get your 155 and pay full tuition at a shitty school.
This is really tough because these people are obviously well-meaning.
Well,
right? We have someone from the Legal Defense Fund, right? They're trying to help people.
Yes, but I've talked to a lot of these people who, okay, well-meaning, sure. I'll give them well-meaning, but so misguided. And their programs—
That's exactly what it is, yeah.
Their programs are oriented to just like, apply now. All the programs that I've seen are oriented to apply now. Like I've seen these pipeline initiatives where the first thing they have the kids work on is their personal statement.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? Why are we wasting time on that? That's what you would do if you want people to apply now, right? Yeah. Like it's like working on your credit application before you've picked out a fucking car.
Yeah. Get ready. Get ready to spend that money.
Oh, a dealer was just, I'm like, hey, can I get an invoice for this? This is the exact car that I want. I want an invoice for that.
Yeah.
And in the email that comes back, it's like, well, blah, 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 blah. Well, why don't you get started on the credit application? No. Give me an invoice for the damn car. Well, these people, it's just urging people down this path of deciding when you want to start law school and then giving you this like, single date for the LSAT, like, oh, we'll just, take it anytime in this window and you're good, without acknowledging the reality that you are allowed 5 attempts, only your highest score counts in the vast majority of cases, only your high score counts. You're allowed 5 attempts. How the hell does this chart make any sense?
It doesn't make sense. It also says for people who want to start in fall of 2025, an excellent time to start studying for the LSAT is summer of 2024. But you could be studying
in summer of 2024.
Take the LSAT in summer of 2024. Why not start studying for it now, right? Yeah. So you can take it over the next year.
Right.
It's wild.
Why would you put it off? Like, why would you think, right, the exact opposite. This chart fails in so many ways because if you do want to start law school in fall of 2025, right now is the perfect time to start studying.
Yeah.
You could start studying now. And as soon as you're ready, maybe you will be ready this fall to take the LSAT. There's nothing wrong with taking the LSAT this fall.
Yeah.
And then just holding your application and applying in September of 2024 to start school in 2025.
Dude, I got to go back for a half second. You just said that car application person was like, hey, why don't you start filling out your loan, right?
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
That makes me, it made me slightly nauseous.
Yeah.
And the reason why it made me nauseous is because it's the presumption of the industry that you need financing to buy a car.
Yeah. Oh, you should. You should. We've got this neighbor buddy that Wade and I talk about, who he had this Audi, and he borrowed the maximum to get the Audi.
Ugh.
He's a bartender. He's a great guy, but he's just like, he's the typical American dumbass. Borrow as much money as you can for a car that you can't really afford. Make the payments. 3 years, 5 years later, he's finally about to make his last payment. What do you think he's doing?
He's getting another car.
Yeah. He's shopping for another car because that's what you do. You just have a car.
That's
payment.
Actually almost like for these days, if you can pay it off in 3 to 5 years, that's almost like a success story, right? Like a lot of people aren't even close to paying it off.
Do they have longer car loans than that?
From what I understand, they're starting to extend them.
Ugh.
Yeah. Ugh. It's just so bad. And that's a freaking car loan. That's recoverable. We're talking about law school debt, astronomically higher.
Yeah.
And he's still got a job, right? He's working as a bartender. You go to law school, you're giving up that income. You're giving up income and taking out loads more debt. Anyways, sorry. The fact that makes me nauseous is concerning because we're talking about things that are orders of magnitude bigger.
I can't believe that they're ignoring the reality that people take the test multiple times. That just strikes me as so crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had a poll later that was kind of weird. It was asking, what are you using for your LSAT prep?
Mm.
And you could pick multiple answers. Go ahead.
Well, they were weird to me because they didn't seem to capture all the options very clearly. I don't know.
Right. So free prep tests on Law Hub, most people were doing that. Additional prep tests, I guess, that you can buy through Law Hub Advantage, only some of the people were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Books, a lot of people are still using books, apparently, which is fine. About a third of the people were taking a test prep class. Less than 10% are doing one-on-one LSAT tutoring. About a third of the people are looking at free videos and articles. Be careful there because there's so much bad advice out there.
Yep.
9% say I'm using another approach to prep for the LSAT. I wondered why they didn't have like what we do. Why is that not in the poll?
Yeah, like an app or...
We're 3 years post COVID, right? There's apps, there's websites, there's all kinds of online things that you might not call a class. I guess Demon Live is classes.
You know,
so maybe that catches that. But if you're a Demon Basic or Demon Premium student, what do you select in this poll?
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't know because it's not a class. So I don't know what it is. Anyway, let's see. What else did I want to talk about from these notes? Oh, LSAC presented a thing that says the LSAT .. Fair, valid, and reliable. And then it had some bullet points that I think I might agree with all six of these bullet points. You want to read them?
Sure. Mirrors the 1L experience, helps in transitioning to a new learning environment, and helps prepare for a career in law.
Elizabeth was like, I can't believe how much she just finished her 1L year at Harvard Law School. And she was in my class the other day saying, I can't believe how much my LSAT prep equipped me for the kind of close reading is going to be required in law school. She's like, it's a perfect test. Get good at the LSAT. You're going to be getting good at law school while you do that.
Yeah. Number two, tests critical thinking and reading comprehension skills.
I think that's just right. And that is that is exactly what the LSAT test. It's like kind of nothing more, nothing less.
Yep.
The thing I might add is how hard you can work, because it is a really, you can prep for it. You can, if you work your ass off, you really will improve. So I think it's also, you know, the test itself, like on the surface, it's testing. Are you reading it? Can you comprehend what you're reading? Like, are you reading it carefully and actually understanding what it says? And are you thinking critically about it? Attacking arguments, looking for bottlenecks in the games. So that's a really great description, right? Of what the test tests.
Yeah.
Plus how hard you can work because you keep grinding on it.
Yeah, for sure. Number three, no tricks or secrets to answering test questions correctly.
Say that again. No tricks or secrets to answering test questions correctly. It's just not a gimmicky test.
Yeah.
Smart people can solve the questions. Smart people given unlimited time can solve the questions by reading them carefully without any prior knowledge, any tricks, any secrets. It's just there.
Yeah. Well, and they're saying this too, because so many people, right, hear from other test preparation companies, people, quote unquote experts, who say, you know, like, oh, on the LSAT, you need to make sure that.
Right. On the LSAT, this means this other thing. And it's like, well, actually, on the LSAT, what it means is the definition of what it.
Yeah. If you look that up, that's what it means. And people are being sloppy about that term in everyday life. And so they, of course, they're going to get mixed up.
Right. So then there was some basic stuff about LSAT format and content. I don't think we need to talk about that.
Well, they do have a section here on to retake or not to retake.
Oh, okay, let's look at that.
Okay, so it says post-mortem analysis. Were there extenuating circumstances that negatively impacted my test day experience? I guess my first question would be, what was your score and how does that compare to your practice test scores? But here's that question now. Does my actual score reflect my progress? Parentheses, practice test scores. Yeah. Okay, great.
Well, that's, I mean, that's an excellent one, right? They should have started with that. They should have started by talking about retakes. They should have started with like, look, here's what you really need to do. You need to do enough of these practice tests and study them so that you understand them, so that you can figure out like what your take time to practice tests and get your practice test into a range that you're comfortable with. Then you should take the official LSAT. Then post-mortem analysis, does your actual score reflect your practice tests?
Yeah.
Because if it doesn't, then you are obviously 100% retake, but that's not what they say.
Mm-hmm. They bury this with other questions and they just...
Well, and then they say...
Have I identified any missteps or areas for improvement? Huh?
And is it the right time to retake? Which is like, well, I thought I was asked, what? Is it the right time to retake? Is like, well, but don't you want to apply this cycle?
Yeah, that's, is it too late?
But then look at the next two bullet points under to retake or not to retake part two.
Can I get into law school with the score I have?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, of course you can. You can get in any school. Well, like there are schools, right, that will take almost any score.
Right.
So,
yeah. Can I get into law school with the score I have? Yeah. If you have a 145, you can get into some trash law school somewhere. That's not a good question to ask.
This is really bad. And the next one gets worse. Well, I mean, the next one's better, but here's the problem with it. It says, can I get into the law school of my choice with what I have? Okay. So that's a little bit of a more selective question, which is good. But like I said earlier in the show, right, you have this self-rationalization, like, okay, I wanted top 10, I wanted top 15, I wanted top 20. I can't quite get there, but I could work with a top, you know, 50 school, a regional school. You just start compromising, settling.
I think maybe that's about it. Down at the bottom, at the end of class, there was a Q&A. They talked about the rolling admissions timeline a little bit. They acknowledged that it is true that the later you wait to apply, the fewer spots will be available and the fewer spots will get scholarships. But they are then saying that they start to see that drop off in February. And they also said that taking the test by November will put you in the best position possible, which that might be true at some schools that don't evaluate any applications until January. It's also only going to be true if you get your best LSAT by November.
Yeah.
But this advice is going to people who are mostly like probably taking the test for the first time or maybe the second time.
Yeah.
And then they're thinking, oh, okay, so one and done, as long as I take it by November, I'll be in the best position possible. No, you won't if you're Elizabeth with a 160 something and you were capable of a 175. Like, you're not in your best position because you did not give the LSAT the best possible. You didn't put the work in.
Yeah.
Didn't put the time in. You're not going to be in the best position possible, even if you apply on September 1st with a shitty LSAT. Okay. Anything more about that?
Nope. Yeah. All right.
Thank you for sending in those notes. Appreciate it. Now we have this. This could take a while. This is an anonymous friend of the demon who is currently at Yale Law, who shared extensive notes about loan repayment assistance programs. She says, LRAP programs can be a good reason to try to go to a T14, but even within the T14 and even within the so-called T3, there is a huge variation in the details of these programs and, in bold, the programs don't work for everyone.
If you're a listener of this show, that should be no surprise, right? The devil's in the details, and what exactly they're promising to give you back matters, because if it hinges on certain criteria and you don't meet those criteria, you're not going to get assistance with your loan.
Yeah.
And I'm not shocked at all that there is even just one sentence differences between these agreements for, say, a T3 school or even a T14 school.
Yeah.
That drastically reduces the number of people who could be eligible to get assistance.
Not only that, but we have an anonymous quote here from someone else, not our Yale Law correspondent who wrote all the write-up that we're going to read to you in just a second. But we have an anonymous quote here from someone who was talking to Berkeley about their loan repayment assistance program. And the Berkeley representative basically said, "This stuff is changing all the time, and any answer I give you now probably won't be true in 3 years when you graduate."
Holy shit. Well, that's also not surprising because so many legal agreements say modifiable, right? They say that the agreement is modifiable without your consent. You've agreed to any future updates to the terms of this agreement. So of course, law schools are putting that in there so that they can protect themselves and change things if they need to. The fact that Berkeley was candid about that surprises me.
So it says the short answer is that yes, loan repayments assistance programs, it's an acronym, right? LRAP. Mm-hmm. Yes, LRAP programs can be a good reason to try to go to a top 14, but even within the top 14, there's huge variation in the details of the programs, and the programs don't work for everyone. Factors to consider. Why don't you start off with some of these, Ben?
Okay. Is it a loan repayment or a loan forgiveness program? If it's a loan forgiveness program, it is tied to the federal government's program.
Well, is it tied to the federal government?
Is it tied to the federal government? Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Question. Yeah. And then the comment here is, if it is tied to the feds, I would have serious concerns about the long-term viability of the program and the pretty serious limitations on the type of public interest work you can do. Interesting. So some of these programs, so first it's like, okay, are they repaying my loan, or are they just forgiving a loan that I've already paid or have yet to pay? I'm not even sure the difference there. And then if it is a forgiveness program, did they just wrap it into the federal program? And so now you're subject to all the whims of politics.
Well, you know, we get the wrong, well, I don't know. I don't even want to take a position on whether these programs are a good idea or a bad idea. But you get a change in the White House, you get a change in Congress, and all of a sudden the federal program could just disappear entirely. LRAP stands for Loan Repayment Assistance Program. And so normally it's repayment, right? Not forgiveness, it's repayment. And they're actually helping you make the payments. And then forgiveness is usually the thing that happens at the end, where they just like wipe out the debt at the end.
At the end. Yeah.
And so what our correspondent is telling us here is that if you're looking at the portion that is meant to forgive the balance of the loan, you've got to be careful. And if it's just theirs, then great. Well, then you just, do you trust that their program will still be there?
Well,
and
that's,
you know,
interesting.
If it's Harvard with its multi-billion-dollar endowment, then you might go, yeah, okay, they can probably forgive it. But
that's
if
tough,
it's,
though, because it's big risk, right? You're waiting to the end for this to happen, and if it doesn't happen, you're fucked. But but with the loan repayment program, you see it happening as you go. It's like, okay, making loan payments.
Yeah, but normally you're in income-based repayment, and they're just going to barely be paying. Like, they might not even be servicing the the interest on the loan, right? They're just, you're making your qualifying payments so that you can qualify for this federal loan forgiveness program. It's two separate programs, and that's what people really need to pay attention to. Next bullet point says, how long does the program last? Which of your loans are eligible? Does the program cover bar loans or clerkship loans? Does it cover private loans or just loans from Uncle Sam? These are all questions that you need to be asking before you sign your name on the dotted line. Because I think that the schools, you know, they just kind of blithely go, oh, well, we have an LRAP. You know, our LRAP program's great. So just, yeah, public interest. Oh, yeah, just, you know, go get our LRAP. Yeah, you're good. And it's like, well, wait a second. How do I survive while I'm clerking? How do I survive when I'm taking the bar?
Yeah.
If I get loans that aren't just federal loans, but I also get some of these plus loans or private loans, is that going to be covered? These are all questions that, you know, if you don't ask, they're just going to get you to sign up.
Yeah.
Next one, another question that you need to ask. What type of work qualifies for the program? Only work for a 501c3 or for a government? Or does maybe public interest work broadly defined count? Or maybe just any low paying work?
That's quite a range, right?
Yeah.
For instance, Stanford's program is very generous, but you must get certified continually by the program to remain in it. The board that runs it has to approve your work to ensure it fits their, quote, public interest law criteria. In contrast, Yale's program is much less generous in terms of dollar amounts, but covers any work that fits the income criteria, including practicing law, policy work, low-paid private sector work, teaching high school, working as a clown, you name it. Yeah.
Go teach LSAT and don't get paid if you work part time or whatever and don't get paid, you know, enough. As long as you're under the dollar amount at Yale, then Yale's like, yeah, sure, that's fine. You're poor.
That's wild. I mean, it's also not surprising. That's how these things work. You got to become an attorney to understand.
Oh, yeah.
What you're getting into. Right.
Yeah, for sure.
This is why I would actually like, there's part of me that just wants to stop and say, don't rely on this.
Well, that's why getting a scholarship is better in every instance. And that's what they say at the very end. You know, there's a bold line at the very end of this 3-page write up that says, this is why getting a scholarship on the front end is the best possible outcome for most people. So because we run into people who are like, oh, no, but I'm doing public interest, so I don't have to worry about it because I'm going to get my loans forgiven. And it's like, OK, great. Well, then here, look at these 3 pages worth of shit that you should probably be thinking about.
And that's still assuming that you want to do public interest in 5 years, right? Maybe you do the first 2 years out of law school and then you're like, I hate this shit. I need to get out of here. You're stuck.
Nobody thinks that's going to happen to them, but it happens to half of the people who try to go down this road. I mean, it happened to a real close friend of mine who wanted to work in immigration law, did 3 years at Hastings, does not work in immigration law. I do not know if she's going to get her loans repaid or not. It's perilous. It's treacherous. Yeah. And she turned down a scholarship too. She could have gone to, you know, like I did, she could have gone to Golden Gate with a scholarship, and instead she ends up going to Hastings, paying full price and then not practicing law, which maybe that means that the Hastings LRAP doesn't even, you know, or if Hastings even has an LRAP, if they do, it's probably a shitty one. And it probably doesn't cover anything other than like legal work. I don't know. You'd have to read the fine print of that exact agreement.
There's a name for this flaw. It's called the self-consistency fallacy.
Oh?
It's the misguided assumption that I have always acted in a certain way, therefore I must continue to act in this way.
Oh,
but we change.
Yeah. The older you get, the more you realize how much you change over time. Ben and I are both mid 40s, and it's like, it's crazy how much we've, even the time we've known each other, Ben.
Yeah. Seriously.
It's crazy how dramatically we've changed. And for a 21-year-old who's like, oh, but I'm committed to working on the environment. You know, I'm going to be a law firm. I don't know who pays you to work on behalf of the environment, but I'm going to be a lawyer and save the planet. And I've always, since high school, you know, okay. Yeah. You're 21. A lot might happen in the next couple of decades, and you might still have the debt that you incurred when you were 21 if you're not smart about how you do this.
Yeah.
Next bullet says, if your loans are repaid or forgiven, do you have to pay taxes on that assistance as income? Under what circumstances? If so, does the program help cover that? How do they do? Why don't you read this next bit?
For many programs, you will have to pay taxes on the assistance unless you work for a narrow subset of U.S. employers, often 501c3 or government employers. If you work abroad or work in a fellowship funded by your law school, your assistance may be taxed. That means that you will never really see the money. It goes to your loans, but you have to pay taxes on it nonetheless. That is true. The tax code gets people all the time for loan forgiveness, right? Someone forgives you for a loan, they consider that income because now you don't have to pay back that debt.
Yeah. And if it was like $200,000 worth of principal at the end of the 10-year, because if you were in income-based repayment, you might not even be paying the interest on the loan. So it could actually be going up. It could be well over $200,000.
Oh, God,
you could have $400,000 in debt at the end of this 10-year income-based repayment situation.
Yeah.
And if you had that $400,000 of debt forgiven, and if the IRS says, hey, guess what? That's taxable.
By the way, your income bracket is now, 25%, 30%?
Top 200,000 of that, at least, you're going to be paying 40% of that.
Yeah.
And so, you're going to end up with there's $150,000 tax bill due right now to the IRS. And you got no cash, by the way.
Wait, I didn't get money. I just didn't have to pay money. And they're like, we don't give a shit.
You can probably work out a settlement with them at that point, right? I imagine you could go in and say, hey, look, here's what happened. I do not have this cash. I need to work out an agreement with you. And then, sure, no problem. You'll just start paying interest on that. It's like, essentially, now you just owe the money. You owe the tax.
You owe less because the tax is a percentage of that.
Instead of $400,000, you now owe $150,000 to the IRS.
But what are the terms of that agreement, and what length of time is it over? Right,
they're going to charge you some interest, and
don't take out fucking loans. That's the lesson of all this.
Next bullet says, does the program cover work abroad? In at least some cases, the answer is no. So be careful if working abroad is something that you're interested in. How do different life events affect the terms of the program? You read.
For instance, getting married to a partner with a larger income, having children, needing to leave the workforce to care for a family member, or having a child with disabilities. Oh, man, all very real possibilities, by the way. Such events can affect both, one, how much of your income you're expected to put toward your loans, and two, how much time you're allowed to take out of the workforce while remaining in the program.
Yeah, there's some risk that if you have kids and drop out for a while, but am I still going to qualify for this program? I'm not working anymore for a while. Getting married can be a big problem because if they lump your incomes together, then now all of a sudden, poof, you're back on the hook for that $400,000 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Okay. Next one. What amortization schedule does the program put you on?
For instance, Yale uses a 15-year amortization schedule for the first 5 years and then a 5-year amortization schedule for the next 5 years. Harvard, in contrast, uses a straight 10-year schedule. This means that if you have to exit the program for some reason, exceeding the income limit, leaving the workforce, taking a job that does not qualify, around the 5 or 6 year mark, you will have paid off much more of your debt through Harvard's program than Yale's. That's interesting.
That is interesting. Really? So Yale, it looks like Yale's program has a little bit of a gotcha there where it's like, well, we're only amortizing you into this program on a 15-year schedule for the first 5 years, which means that in the first year, you only get 1/15th of it.
Wow.
Like included into the program.
Small change. Yeah.
Yeah. So you have to stay in it for the full. It looks like I'm not sure exactly how the math is working out on all this, but it seems like you need to stay in it for the long haul in order to
really benefit. Cause it's lopsided. I mean, they're doing a 5-year schedule on the last 5 years. So
yeah. And the only possible explanation for that, right, is just like, well, we just don't want people to drop out of this program. If people drop out of the program early, we do not want to have to pay for that. So they're paying it off real slow at the beginning is what they're basically
doing. It's almost like a vesting clause, right?
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
But Harvard is doing it on a straight 10-year schedule. It's like, oh, if you make it halfway, then you get half paid off. Yale's like, if you make it halfway, you got almost none of it paid off.
Huh.
Yeah. What assets are protected from the program?
For instance, you can contribute to your retirement without having those contributions count. Can you contribute to your retirement without having those contributions count as income? What about money you already have in retirement, in a retirement account, in a savings account?
Okay. Things you need to consider. Maybe if you have money in a 401k or something, you might already be disqualified from this program before you even start. Or that those assets are going to get counted in. And yeah. Is there a negative amortization risk? That is it possible that your balance could continue going up even while you're in the program?
This happens when the payments don't cover the interest, which you just mentioned earlier. That's really bad.
Yeah. Does the program cover clerkships? Under what circumstances? Sometimes they count, sometimes they don't.
Yep.
Is there any cost of living adjustment based on where in the world you are?
Usually no, and that's underlined, which means that the utility of the program will pay out very differently depending on where you end up.
Why don't you keep going? This is an interesting example.
Okay. Our correspondent says, I think that this last point is especially important. It's something I've been thinking about a lot. If a graduate works in a very low-paying job, the program could repay their loans entirely. If the cost of living is also low, they could live pretty well on even a low salary. But if a graduate is doing the same work in New York City, LA, or San Francisco, even with the exact same standard of living due to higher cost, they might get no help. This is key. By way of example, imagine that I want to be a public defender. I'm choosing between a job that offers job offers in Kentucky, New York City. I cannot say that Alaskan town. Can you pronounce that?
Utqavik.
Okay. Thanks for including that town in Alaska and San Francisco. I have $150,000 of law school loans accruing 6% annual interest, and I want to enroll in Yale's LRAP program called COAP. I don't know.
COAP.
Assume that my salary increases by 5% each year. Starting salary in Kentucky is $52,000. Over 10 years, I pay $29,000. Over 10 years, Yale pays, $178,000. Pretty sweet deal, as long as the cost of living in Kentucky stays low. But the cost of living might not stay low, especially as we millennials continue to flee the big cities for mid-sized cities in the Southeast and Midwest. Okay.
Kentucky's always going to be cheap, but
yeah,
okay.
I don't know about that one. Anyway, starting salary at Legal Aid Society in New York City, $75,000.
Okay. So making $23,000 or more per year, like 50% more income.
Yeah. And Yale doesn't care where you live. So it's like, hey, you're making more money than you that was in Kentucky. So over 10 years, this correspondent says I pay $153,000.
Holy shit. Wow. But that's only, you're still only making 75 grand.
Yeah. That's
and
wild.
Now this Yale program is like, yeah, but if you're making 75,000, then you can afford to pay a lot more toward your loans. I can't believe that. That's shocking. You pay 153 now. Instead of 30,000. So going somewhere with a low cost of living makes a lot of sense for this program.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look how much Yale pays. They, instead of paying 178, they only pay 55.
55. Yeah.
Or 179 down to 55. That's crazy.
So then this correspondent says, meh, it's still generous, but that's over 150K that I can't use to pay for my rent and groceries in New York City, New York freaking city. This is doable, but it's going to be tough. I don't want to be a 40-year-old sharing an apartment with five other roommates. Okay. Wow. Starting salary in this hard to pronounce Alaskan city, which has an astronomical cost of living, like $15 for a gallon of milk.
Mm.
Wow. Okay. Starting salary is $113,000.
Because, you know, it's 10. Like they have to fly that shit there.
Yeah. Everything is being like airdropped by like special ops.
Yeah.
Okay. Over 10 years, I pay $208,000. Yale pays nothing because now you're making too much money.
Oof.
This is bad. The reason I'm so highly paid is that this is so darn expensive to live here. I can't afford to put 1/5 of my salary toward law school loans in this weird far off town. This is not a viable option for me. I wonder if someone was actually considering this. Anyways, last example is San Francisco. Starting salary is $142,000. Over 10 years, the correspondent pays $208,000. Yale again pays nothing because the starting salary is so high. Hmm. Okay.
And they say this is probably doable despite the notoriously high cost of living. Nathan, you'd know better than I would because I did live in San Francisco for a long time. The one thing I wanted to point out here is that I, as someone who has lived in big cities and I've also lived in smaller places and I've lived all over the place, I strongly encourage people to live in big cities. I think living in big cities is amazing. I think you get what you pay for. And if the cost of living is high in San Francisco, that's because it is fucking awesome to live in San Francisco. And you do make more money while you're there. And I, for people who are considering it, like, oh, I'm a small town person, I'm not sure whether I could, you know, that cost of living just, it seems so outrageous. Yeah, but that's because it's so, so good. It's so cool there. There's so much stuff to do. There's so many opportunities. There's like smart people who are going places and doing things. And a pretty strong advocate for if you enjoy cities, then go ahead and live in a big city. It's awesome. I don't think you're going to regret it.
I wonder where my city fits into your matrix, because I'm like 25 minutes outside of DC. I love the proximity, but I'm not in the city.
No,
and
I mean,
I like you're, the land.
Yeah, you're in the suburbs, and it's okay. I mean, there is a train station, right? You can get downtown.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, I would prefer to be like
in the city.
City proper.
I love this. I love the trees all around my, like, I can't see a lot of my neighbors, you know. It's just like, oh, it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I live in the mountains now, and I regret it pretty much. Like it's too remote.
It's too remote. Rural. Yeah.
It's not quite Utqiagvik, but Utqiagvik, Alaska, but it is kind of similar. Like the it's harder to get shit in the stores, you know, it's just way up here at the top of the mountain and it snows for half the year. And it's quiet, it's peaceful. I don't see my neighbors. I see a bunch of pine trees, but I wish I could walk to the coffee shop. I really miss going out in, you know, if I have to do some work, I want to be in a cafe somewhere. I don't want to be stuck in my house. I can't, you know, I can't walk. Well, yeah, that's a big deal to me, like walking or biking to get coffee. I got so used to it living in, well, I lived in Boston and San Francisco, and even where I lived in LA, I was able to do all that, and I miss it so much. So, it just depends on what kind of a lifestyle you really want. But
yeah.
Okay. Anyway, let's continue with this hell wrap.
Okay.
Stuff.
Last one. Okay. Now let's imagine that instead I take a job doing public interest legal work in Mexico City. Starting salary, $25,000. Over 10 years, pay nothing. But Yale pays $208,000, the whole amount.
Yep.
Seems great. Low cost of living, no loans to pay. But wait, not so fast. Unless my employer in Mexico has U.S. 503C status, I have to pay taxes on the loan repayment each year, which could bump my federal income taxes up as high as $4,300. That figure doesn't even include the FICA taxes on my wages, which would be an additional $2,000. Really? On $25,000? I guess so. That's nearly a quarter of my small salary going into taxes. This is probably not a great option for me either.
Yeah, because you're making so little that if now you're all of a sudden, you know, you're making a Mexico City $25,000 public interest salary, but you're paying U.S. taxes on that, on the loan forgiveness.
Eek.
And yeah, next thing you know, you're like netting. Yeah, she'd be less than $20,000 a year to live.
Here's a key point. So this correspondent continues. All this is to say that these LRAP programs can work well for someone if the stars align, such that their goals and life circumstances match what the program covers at the level at which it covers it. That's the key phrase there. The stars have to fucking align.
Yeah.
And I don't think they do very often.
No, I think that, I mean, there's a reason why they don't just pay it up front, right? Like all these programs work along the lines of, oh, you borrow the money from the government. We get that money instantly.
Yep. It's a very lopsided deal.
You owe the money to the government now. And then, oh yeah, we have this loan repayment assistance program plus this federal program that forgives the loan. And so, yeah, then if the stars align, and it's all this crazy shit, like you have to apply for it. They give it to you later than you thought you were going to get it. You reapply every 6 months in some cases to continue. It's like, oh, you make the payment yourself. Then you apply. Then they maybe reimburse you for the payment. It's all these ways that they're just trying to keep hold of that money, right? And I would love to know what the payout percentage is of like people who think that this is going to work for them versus what actually happens. Like dollar for dollar, what do you think it is? Like 50 cents on the dollar that ever gets like actually repaid?
Oh, lower.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one way to design a fair system is to actually ask somebody to design the system before they know the role that they're going to be in that system.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. Like clearly the school knows its position. And so then it's creating a system that serves its needs. But if you're like, you don't know what side of the agreement you're going to be on here, go ahead and set out the rules.
Yeah.
One way to test that is to say, okay, like you just said, right, they don't get the money up front. What if they had to get paid over time? Right.
Like what if they just, right. Well, what if there was no loan in the first place? What if it was just, what if the school was like, because it's an artificially priced product in the first place, right? It's just what, how the hell is this $55,000 a year of tuition? Instead, they could just say, oh, you want to work in public interest? Good. We're going to make a public interest lawyer out of you. Come to our school for free then. It could be as simple as that.
If you make more, pay us back.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So how would that work out for them?
Yeah. Yeah. They would.
No, it is insane. And it's great for their marketing, right? It's great for the school's marketing because at every step along the way, they can say, oh, and if you want to do public interest, we have these very generous LRAP programs and it can help you to repay your loan and your whole loan could just get forgiven. And so it's like they just sell this fantasy to kids that like, oh, well, I'm going to work in public interest, so I don't need to worry about the cost.
Yeah.
So I'll just go ahead and borrow $250,000, hand it over immediately to the school. And then hopefully that debt will go away at some point.
Hopefully.
And hopefully I won't be taxed on it when it does. Our correspondent wraps up by saying,
yep,
a single person wanting to do public interest work in a low paying, low cost of living part of the country may be okay. They won't live like a queen, but they will get most of their loans repaid by someone else, which is nice. But someone with a more complicated situation or who wants to live in New York City, California, or abroad will face a tougher road. And I would say that is like at least half of the people are thinking, oh, I want to be, you know, somewhere big. The big places have lots of people.
Yeah.
And that's just going to be tougher.
Yeah.
And then they wrap up again with, this is why getting a scholarship on the front end is the best possible outcome for most people.
100%. I want to tweak one thing that they say here. They say they won't live like a queen, but they will get most of their loans repaid by someone else, which is nice. I would change that will to may or might be eligible for because even if you have all these characteristics satisfied, right? Single person doing public interest work in a low paying, low cost of living part of the country.
The schools themselves, like,
other qualifications.
Yeah. And the schools themselves acknowledge that even their programs, like you can do all the research you want, you can dig into their programs right now. But by the time you graduate, their program might have changed. The federal government could change its program at any time. Your life circumstances can change. You can get married. You 100%. Can change your priorities. You can have a kid. You can have all kinds of different shit happen. And yeah, that's why our mission is to get you to just not pay for law school in the first place. The law yep. schools give generous scholarships. They give those scholarships mostly in to try to attract high LSAT, high GPA candidates. And even if you're not a high GPA candidate, you can still be a high LSAT candidate. And if you study hard, work your ass off, you can end up not paying for law school. You want to wrap it up there?
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you, everybody, for your thoughtful emails. Really appreciate that. Please ask us questions or share news with us at thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about our product, the LSAT Demon, we think it is by far the best way to study for the LSAT. If you want to try to get one of those 15 or 20 or 25 point or 34 point improvements like we talked about on the show today, email the best customer service team in the world. That's help@lsatdemon.com, or just go to lsatdemon.com and sign up for a free account. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 419 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.